cried out as though from the pain of my side, and Alice came to ease me into a less agonizing position. She wiped my face with a cool, damp cloth. "I'll try again," I said to her, and I wondered why I was saying it, boasting, maybe lying. "What?" she asked. My swollen face and mouth were still distorting my speech. I would have to repeat the words. Maybe they would give me courage if I said them often enough.
"I'll try again."
I spoke as slowly and as clearly as I could. "You rest." Her voice was suddenly rough, and I knew she had understood. "Time enough later for talking. Go to sleep." But I couldn't sleep. The pain kept me awake. My own thoughts kept me awake. I caught myself wondering whether I would be sold to some passing trader this time or next time. I longed for my sleeping pills to give me oblivion, but some small part of me was glad I didn't have them. I didn't quite trust myself with them just now. I wasn't quite sure how many of them I might take. 14. Liza, the sewing woman, fell and hurt herself. Alice told me all about it. Liza was bruised and battered. She lost some teeth. She was black and blue all over. Even Tom Whalen was concerned.
"Who did this to you?" he demanded. "Tell me and they'll be punished."
"I fell," she said sullenly. "Fell on the stairs."
Whalen cursed her for a fool and told her to get out of his sight. And Alice, Tess, and Carrie concealed their few scratches and gave Liza quiet, meaningful glances. Glances that Liza turned away from in anger and fear. "She heard you get up in the night," Alice told me. "She got up after you and went straight to Mr. Tom. She knew better than to go to Mr. Roof. He might have let you go. Mr. Tom never let a nigger go in his life."
"But why?"
I asked from my pallet. I was stronger now, but Rufus had forbidden me to get up. For once, I was glad to obey. I knew that when I got up, Tom Whalen would expect me to work as though I were completely well. Thus, I had missed Liza's accident completely. "She did it to get at me," said Alice. "She would have liked it better if I had been the one slipping out at night. But she hates you, too, and almost as much. She figures I would have died if not for you." I was startled. I had never had a serious enemy, someone who would go out of her way to get me hurt or killed. To slaveholders and patrollers, I was just one more nigger, worth so many dollars. What they did to me didn't have much to do with me personally. But here was a woman who hated me and who, out of sheer malice, had nearly killed me.
"She'll keep her mouth shut next time," said Alice. "We let her know what would happen to her if she didn't. Now she's more scared of us than of Mr. Tom."
"Don't get yourselves in trouble over me," I said.
"Don't be telling us what to do," she replied.
15. The first day I was up, Rufus called me to his room and handed me a letter from Kevin to Tom Whalen. "Dear Tom," it said, "there may be no need for this letter since I hope to reach you ahead of it. If I'm held up, however, I want you and Dana to know that I'm coming. Please tell her I'm coming." It was Kevin's handwriting, slanted, neat, clear. In spite of the years of note-taking and longhand drafts, his writing had never gone to hell the way mine had. I looked blankly at Rufus.
"I said once Daddy was a fair man," he said. "You all but laughed out loud."
"He wrote to Kevin about me?"
"He did. After
he learned that you hadn't sent my letters." His eyes widened with surprise, then slowly took on a look of understanding.
"So that's why you ran. How did you find out?"
"By being curious." I glanced at the bed chest. "By satisfying my curiosity.
You could be whipped for snooping through my things.
I shrugged, and small pains shot through my scabby shoulders.
I never even saw they had been moved. I'll have to watch you better from now on.
Why? Are you planning to hide more lies from me? He jumped, started to get up, then sat back down heavily and rested one polished boot on his bed.
Watch what you say, Dana. There are things I won't take, even from you.
You lied, I repeated deliberately. You lied to me over and over. Why, Ruth? It took several seconds for his anger to dissolve and be replaced by something else. I watched him at first, then looked away uncomfortably.
I wanted to keep you here, he whispered. Kevin hates this place. He would have taken you up north.
I looked at him again and let myself understand. It was that destructive, single-minded love of his. He loved me. Not the way he loved Alice, thank God. He didn't seem to want to sleep with me. But he wanted me around. Someone to talk to. Someone who would listen to him and care what he said. Care about him. And I did. However little sense it made, I cared. I must have. I kept forgiving him for things. I stared out the window guiltily, feeling that I should have been more like Alice. She forgave him nothing, forgot nothing, hated him as deeply as she had loved Isaac. I didn't blame her. But what good did her hating do? She couldn't bring herself to run away again or to kill him and face her own death. She couldn't do anything at all except make herself more miserable. She said, "My stomach just turns every time he puts his hands on me." But she endured. Eventually, she would bear him at least one child. And as much as I cared for him, I could not have done that. I couldn't have. Twice, he had made me lose enough control to try to kill him. I could get that angry with him, even though I knew the consequences of killing him. He could drive me to a kind of unthinking fury. Somehow, I couldn't take from him the kind of abuse I took from others. If he ever raped me, it wasn't likely that either of us would survive. Maybe that was why we didn't hate each other. We could hurt each other too badly, kill each other too quickly in hatred. He was like a younger brother to me. Alice was like a sister. It was so hard to watch him hurting her, to know that he had to go on hurting her if my family was to exist at all. And at that moment, it was hard for me to talk calmly about what he had done to me. North, I said finally. Yes, at least there I could keep the skin on my back. He sighed. I never wanted Daddy to whip you. But hell, don't you know you got off easy? He didn't hurt you nearly as much as he's hurt others. I said nothing. He couldn't let a runaway go without some punishment. If he did, there'd be 10 more taken off tomorrow. He was easy on you, though, because he figured your running away was my fault. It was. It was your own fault. If you had waited, for what? You were the one I trusted. I did wait until I found out what a liar you were. He took the charge without anger this time. Oh, hell, Dana. All right. I should have sent the letters. Even Daddy said I should have sent them after I promised you I would. Then he said I was a damn fool for promising. He paused. But that promise was the only thing that made him send for Kevin. He didn't do it out of gratitude to you for helping me. He did it because I had given my word. If not for that, he would have kept you here till you went home. If you're going to go home this time. We sat together in silence for a moment.
That is the only man I know, he said softly, who cares as much about giving his word to a black as to a white.
Does that bother you?
No, it's one of the few things about him I can respect.
It's one of the few things about him you should copy.
Yeah.
He took his foot off the bed.
Carrie's bringing a tray up here so we can eat together.
That surprised me, but I just nodded.
Your back doesn't hurt much, does it?
Yes. He stared out the window miserably until Carrie arrived with the tray. I went back to helping Sarah and Carrie the next day. Rufus said I didn't have to, but as tedious as the work was, I could stand it easier than I could stand more long hours of boredom. And now that I knew Kevin was coming, my back and side didn't seem to hurt as much. Then Jake Edwards came in to destroy my newfound peace. It was amazing how much misery the man could cause doing the same job Luke had managed to do without hurting anyone.
"You," he said to me.
He knew my name.
"You go do the wash. Tess is going to the fields today."
Poor Tess. Waylon had tired of her as a bedmate and passed her casually to Edwards. She had been afraid Edwards would send her to the fields where he could keep an eye on her. With Alice and I in the house, she knew she could be spared. She had cried with the fear that she would be spared.
"You do everything they tell you," she wept, "and they still treat you like an old dog. Go here. Open your legs. Go there. Bust your back. What they care? I ain't supposed to have no feelings."
She had sat with me crying while I lay on my stomach, sweating and hurting, and knowing I wasn't as bad off as I thought I was. I would be a lot worse off now, though, if I obeyed Edwards. He had no right to give me orders, and he knew it. His authority was over the field hands. But today, Rufus and Tom Whalen had gone into town, leaving Edwards in charge, leaving him several hours to show us how important he was. I'd heard him outside the cookhouse trying to bully Nigel, and I'd heard Nigel's answer, first placating, "I'm just doing what Mars Tom told me to do," finally threatening. "Mars Jake, you put your hands on me, and you gonna get hurt. Now that's all." Edwards backed off. Nigel was big and strong and not one to make idle threats. Also, Rufus tended to back Nigel, and Waylon tended to back Rufus. Edwards had cursed Nigel, then come into the cookhouse to bother me. I had neither the size nor the strength to frighten him, especially now. But I knew what a day of washing would do to my back and side. I'd had enough pain, surely. "Mr. Edwards, I'm not supposed to be washing. Mr. Rufus told me not to." It was a lie, but Rufus would back me, too. In some ways, I could still trust him.
"You lying nigger. You do what I tell you to do."
Edwards loomed over me.
"You think you've been whipped? You don't know what a whipping is yet."
He carried his whip around with him. It was like part of his arm, long and black with its lead-weighted butt. He dropped the coil of it free. And I went out, God help me, and tried to do the wash. I couldn't face another beating so soon. I just couldn't. When Edwards was gone, Alice came out of Carrie's cabin and began to help me. I felt sweat on my face mingling with silent tears of frustration and anger. My back had already begun to ache dully, and I felt dully ashamed. Slavery was a long, slow process of dulling.
"You stop beating them clothes before you fall over," Alice told me. "I'll do this. You go back to the cookhouse."
"He might come back," I said. "You might get in trouble." It wasn't her trouble I was worried about. It was mine. I didn't want to be dragged out of the cookhouse and whipped again.
"Not me," she said. "He knows where I sleep at night."
I nodded. She was right. As long as she was under Rufus's protection, Edwards might curse her, but he wouldn't touch her. Just as he hadn't touched Tess, until Waylon was finished with her.
"Thanks, Alice, but who's that?"
I looked around. There was a white man, gray-bearded and dusty, riding around the side of the main house toward us. I thought at first that it was the Methodist minister. He was a friend and sometime dinner guest of Tom Waylon, in spite of Waylon's indifference to religion. But no children gathered around this man as he rode. The kids always mobbed the minister, and his wife, too, when he brought her along. The couple dispense candy and safe Bible verses. Servants, be obedient to them that are your masters. The kids got candy for repeating the verses. I saw two little girls staring at the gray-bearded stranger, but no one approached him or spoke to him. He rode straight back to us and stopped, sat looking at both of us uncertainly. I opened my mouth to tell him the Waylands weren't home, but in that moment I got a good look at him. I dropped one of Rufus's good white shirts into the dirt and stumbled over to the fence. "Dinah?" he said softly. The question mark in his voice scared me. Didn't he know me? Had I changed so much? He hadn't, beard or no beard. "Kevin, get down. I can't reach you up there." And he was off the horse and over the laundry yard fence, pulling me to him before I could take another breath. The dull ache in my back and shoulders roared to life. Suddenly I was struggling to get away from him. He let me go, confused. "What the?" I went to him again because I couldn't keep away, but I caught his arms before he could get them around me. "Don't. My back is sore."
"Sore from what?"
"From running away to find you."
"Oh, Kevin."
He held me gently now for several seconds. And I thought if we could just go home then, at that moment, everything would be all right. Finally, Kevin stood back from me a little, looked at me without letting me go.
"Who beat you?"
he asked quietly. "I told you, I ran away."
"Who?"
he insisted. "Was it Waylon again?"
"Kevin, forget it."
"Forget?" "Yes, please forget it. I might have to live here again someday." I shook my head. "Hate Waylon all you want to. I do. But don't do anything to him. Let's just get out of here."
It was him, then.
"Yes." He turned slowly and stared toward the main house. His face was lined and grim. He looked more than 10 years older than when I had last seen him. There was a jagged scar across his forehead, the remnant of what must have been a bad wound. This place, this time, hadn't been any kinder to him than it had been to me. But what had it made of him? What might he be willing to do now that he would not have done before?
"Kevin, please, let's just go."
He turned that same hard stare on me. "Do anything to them and I'll suffer for it," I whispered urgently.
"Let's go. Now."
He stared at me a moment longer, then sighed, rubbed his hand across his forehead. He looked at Alice, and because he didn't speak to her, just kept looking. I turned to look at her, too. She was watching us, watching dry-eyed, but with more pain than I had ever seen on another person's face. My husband had come to me finally. Hers would not be coming to her. Then the look was gone, and her mask of toughness was in place again.
"You better do like she says," she told Kevin softly. "Get her out of here while you can. No telling what our good masters will do if you don't."
"You're Alice, aren't you?"
asked Kevin. She nodded as she would have to Waylon or Rufus. They would have gotten a dull, dry yes, sir.
"Used to see you around here sometimes," she said, "back when things made sense."
He made a sound, not quite a laugh.
"Was there ever such a time?"
He glanced at me, then back at her again, comparing.
"Good Lord," he murmured to himself.
Then to her.
"You going to be all right here, finishing this work by yourself?"
"Gonna be fine," she said. "Just get her out of here."
He finally seemed convinced.
"Get your things," he told me.
I almost told him to forget about my things. Extra clothing, medicine, toothbrush, pens, paper, whatever. But here, some of those things were irreplaceable. I climbed the fence, went to the house and up to the attic as quickly as I could and stuffed everything into my bag. Somehow I got out again without being seen, without having to answer questions. At the laundry yard fence, Kevin waited, feeding something to his mare.
I looked at the mare, wondering how tired she was. How far could she carry two people before she had to rest? How far could Kevin go before he had to rest? I looked at him as I reached him and could read weariness now in the dusty lines of his face. I wondered how fast he had traveled to reach me. When had he slept last? For a moment we stood wasting time staring at each other. We couldn't help it. I couldn't anyway. New lines and all, he was so damned beautiful. "It's been 5 years for me," he said. "I know," I whispered. Abruptly, he turned away. "Let's go. Let's put this place behind us for good." Please, God. But not very likely. I turned to say goodbye to Alice, called her name once. She was beating a pair of Rufus's pants, and she kept beating them with no break in her rhythm to indicate that she had heard me. "Alice?" I called louder. She did not turn, did not stop her beating and beating of those pants, though I was certain now that she heard me. Kevin laid a hand on my shoulder, and I glanced at him, then again at her. "Goodbye, Alice," I said this time, not expecting any answer. There was none. Kevin mounted and helped me up behind him. As we headed away, I leaned against Kevin's sweaty back and waited for the regular thump of her beating to fade. But we could still hear it faintly when we met Rufus on the road. Rufus was alone. I was glad of that, at least. But he stopped a few feet ahead of us, frowning, deliberately blocking our way. "Oh, hell," I muttered. "You were just going to leave?" Rufus said to Kevin. "No thanks, nothing at all, just take her and go?" Kevin stared at him silently for several seconds, stared until Rufus began to look uncomfortable instead of indignant. "That's right," Kevin said. Rufus blinked. "Look," he said in a milder tone, "look, why don't you stay for dinner? My father will be back by then. He'd want you to stay." "You can tell your father." I dug my fingers into Kevin's shoulder, cutting off the rush of words before they came insulting in content, as well as in tone. "Tell him we're in a hurry," Kevin finished. Rufus did not move from blocking our path. He looked at me. "Goodbye, Ruf," I said quietly. And without warning, with no perceptible change in mood, Rufus turned slightly and trained his rifle on us. I knew a little about firearms now. It wasn't wise for any but the most trusted slaves to show an interest in them. But then I had been trusted before I ran away. Rufus's gun was a flintlock, a long, slender Kentucky rifle. He had even let me fire it a couple of times before. And I had looked down the barrel of one like it for his sake. This one, however, was aimed more at Kevin. I stared at it, then at the young man holding it. I kept thinking I knew him, and he kept proving to me that I didn't. "Ruf, what are you doing?" I demanded. "Inviting Kevin to dinner," he said. And to Kevin, "Get down. I think Daddy might want to talk to you." People kept warning me about him, dropping hints that he was meaner than he seemed to be. Sarah had warned me, and most of the time she loved him like one of the sons she had lost, and I had seen the marks he occasionally left on Alice. But he had never been that way with me, not even when he was angry enough to be. I had never feared him as I had feared his father. Even now I wasn't as frightened as I probably should have been. I wasn't frightened for myself. That was why I challenged him. "Ruf, if you shoot anybody, it better be me." "Dana, shut up," said Kevin. "You think I won't?" said Rufus. "I think if you don't, I'll kill you." Kevin got down quickly and hauled me down. He didn't understand the kind of relationship Rufus and I had, how dependent we were on each other. Rufus understood, though. "No need for any talk of killing," he said gently, as though he was
quieting an angry child. And then to Kevin in a more normal tone, I just think Daddy might have something to say to you.
About what? Kevin asked.
Well, about her keep, maybe.
My keep? I exploded, pulling away from Kevin. My keep? I've worked hard every day. I've been here until your father beat me so badly I couldn't work. You people owe me, and you, goddammit, owe me more than you could ever pay.
He swung the rifle to where I wanted it, straight at me. Now I would either goad him into shooting me, or shame him into letting us go. Or possibly, I would go home. I might go home wounded or even dead, but one way or another, I would be away from this time, this place. And if I went home, Kevin would go with me. I caught his hand and held it.
What are you going to do, Ruth? Keep us here at gunpoint so you can rob Kevin?
Get back to the house, he said.
His voice had gone hard. Kevin and I looked at each other and I spoke softly. I already know all I ever want to find out about being a slave, I told him. I'd rather be shot than go back in there.
I won't let them keep you, Kevin promised.
Come on.
No, I glared at him. You stay or go as you please. I'm not going back in that house.
Rufus cursed in disgust.
Kevin, put her over your shoulder and bring her in.
Kevin didn't move. I would have been amazed if he had.
Still trying to get other people to do your dirty work for you, aren't you, Ruth? I said bitterly. First your father, now Kevin. To think I wasted my time saving your worthless life.
I stepped toward the mare and caught her reins as though to remount. At that moment, Rufus's composure broke.
You're not leaving, he shouted. Damn you, you're not leaving me.
He was going to shoot. I had pushed him too far. I was Alice all over again, rejecting him. Terrified in spite of myself, I dove past the mare's head, not caring how I fell as long as I put something between myself and the rifle. I hit the ground, not too hard, tried to scramble up and found that I couldn't. My balance was gone. I heard shouting, Kevin's voice, Rufus's voice. Suddenly I saw the gun, blurred but seemingly only inches from my head. I hit at it and missed. It wasn't quite where it appeared to be. Everything was distorted, blurred.
Kevin! I screamed.
I couldn't leave him behind again, not even if my scream made Rufus fire. Something landed heavily on my back, and I screamed again. This time, in pain, everything went dark. The Storm. 1. Home. I couldn't have been unconscious for more than a minute. I came to on the living room floor to find Kevin bending over me. There was no one for me to mistake him for this time. It was him. And he was home. We were home. My back felt as though I'd taken another beating, but it didn't matter. I'd gotten us home without either of us being shot.
I'm sorry, said Kevin.
I focused on him clearly.
Sorry about what? Doesn't your back hurt?
I lowered my head, rested it on his hand.
It hurts.
I fell on you, between Rufus and the horse and you screaming. I didn't know how it happened, but thank God it did happen.
Don't be sorry, Kevin. You're here.
You'd be stranded again if you hadn't fallen on me. He sighed, nodded.
Can you get up?
I think I'd hurt you more by lifting you than you'd hurt yourself by walking. I got up slowly, cautiously, found that it didn't hurt any more to stand than it did to lie down. My head was clear now, and I could walk without trouble.
Go to bed, said Kevin. Get some rest.
Come with me. Something of the expression he'd had when we'd met in the laundry yard came back to him, and he took my hands.
Come with me,
I repeated softly.
Dana, you're hurt. You're back.
Hey.
He stopped, pulled me closer.
5 years?
I whispered.
That long? Yes.
They hurt you. I fingered the scar on his forehead.
That's nothing. It healed years ago, but you...
Please, come with me. He did. He was so careful, so fearful of hurting me. He did hurt me, of course. I had known he would, but it didn't matter. We were safe. He was home. I'd brought him back. That was enough. Eventually, we slept. He wasn't in the room when I awoke. I lay still listening until I heard him opening and closing doors in the kitchen. And I heard him cursing. He had a slight accent, I realized. Nothing really noticeable, but he did sound a little like Rufus and Tom Whalen. Just a little. I shook my head and tried to put the comparison out of my mind. He sounded as though he were looking for something, and after 5 years didn't know where to find it. I got up and went to help. I found him fiddling with the stove, turning the burners on, staring into the blue flame, turning them off, opening the oven, peering in. He had his back to me and didn't see or hear me. Before I could say anything, he slammed the oven door and stalked away, shaking his head. "Christ," he muttered. "If I'm not home yet, maybe I don't have a home." He went into the dining room without noticing me. I stayed where I was, thinking, remembering. I could recall walking along the narrow dirt road that ran past the Whalen house and seeing the house, shadowy in twilight, boxy and familiar, yellow light showing from some of the windows. Whalen was surprisingly extravagant with his candles and oil. I had heard that other people were not. I could recall feeling relief at seeing the house, feeling that I had come home, and having to stop and correct myself, remind myself that I was in an alien, dangerous place. I could recall being surprised that I would come to think of such a place as home. That was more than 2 months ago, when I went to get help for Rufus. I had been home to 1976, to this house, and it hadn't felt that home-like. It didn't now. For one thing, Kevin and I had lived here together for only 2 days. The fact that I'd had 8 extra days here alone didn't really help. The time, the year was right, but the house just wasn't familiar enough. I felt as though I were losing my place here in my own time. Rufus's time was a sharper, stronger reality. The work was harder. The smells and tastes were stronger. The danger was great. The pain was worse. Rufus's time demanded things of me that had never been demanded before, and it could easily kill me if I didn't meet its demands. That was a stark, powerful reality that the gentle conveniences and luxuries of this house, of now, could not touch. And if I felt that way after spending only short periods in the past, what must Kevin be feeling after 5 years? His white skin had saved him from much of the trouble I had faced, but still, he couldn't have had an easy time. I found him in the living room trying knobs on the television set. It was new to us, that television, like the house. The on-off switch was under the screen out of sight, and Kevin clearly didn't remember. I went to it, reached under, and switched the set on. There was a public service announcement on advising women to see their doctors and take care of themselves while they were pregnant. "Turn it off," said Kevin. I obeyed. "I saw a woman die in childbirth once," he said. I nodded. I never saw it, but I kept hearing about it happening. It was pretty common back then, I guess. Poor medical care or none at all. Nah. Medical care had nothing to do with the case that I saw. This woman's master strung her up by her wrists and beat her until the baby came out of her, dropped onto the ground. I swallowed, looked away, rubbing my wrists. I see. Would Whalen have done such a thing to one of his pregnant slave women, I wondered? Probably not.
He had more business sense than that. Dead mother, dead baby, dead loss. I'd heard stories, though, about other slaveholders who didn't care what they did. There was a woman on Wayland's plantation whose former master had cut 3 fingers from her right hand when he caught her writing. She had a baby nearly every year, that woman. 9 so far, 7 surviving. Wayland called her a good breeder, and he never whipped her. He was selling off her children, though, 1 by 1. Kevin stared at the blank TV screen, then turned away with a bitter laugh. "I feel like this is just another stopover," he said. "A little less real than the others, maybe." "Stopover? Like Philadelphia, like New York and Boston, like that farm in Maine." "You did get to Maine, then?" "Yes. Almost bought a farm there. Would have been a stupid mistake. Then a friend in Boston forwarded me Wayland's letter. Home at last, I thought, and you." He looked at me. "Well, I got half of what I wanted. You're still you." I went to him with relief that surprised me. I hadn't realized how much I'd worried, even now, that I might not be still me, as far as he was concerned. "Everything is so soft here," he said. "So easy." "I know. It's good. Hell, I wouldn't go back to some of the pest holes I've lived in for pay. But still." We were walking through the dining room, through the hall. We stopped at my office, and he went in to look at the map of the United States that I had on the wall. "I kept going farther and farther up the East Coast," he said. "I guess I would have wound up in Canada next. But in all my traveling, do you know the only time I ever felt relieved and eager to be going to a place?" "I think so," I said quietly. "It was when..." He stopped, realizing what I had said, and frowned at me. "It was when you went back to Maryland," I said, "when you visited the Waylands to see whether I was there." He looked surprised, but strangely pleased. "How could you know that?" "It's true, isn't it?" "It's true." "I felt it the last time Rufus called me. I've got no love at all for that place, but so help me, when I saw it again, it was so much like coming home that it scared me." Kevin stroked his beard. "I grew this to come back." "Why?" "To disguise myself. You ever hear of a man named Denmark Vesey? The freedman who plotted rebellion down in South Carolina?" "Yes." "Well, Vesey never got beyond the planning stage, but he scared the hell out of a lot of white people, and a lot of black people suffered for it. Around that time, I was accused of helping slaves to escape. I barely got out ahead of the mob." "Were you at the Waylands then?" "No. I had a job teaching school." He rubbed the scar on his forehead. "I'll tell you about it, Dana, but some other time. Now, somehow, I've got to fit myself back into 1976. If I can."
"You can."
He shrugged. "One more thing, just one." He looked at me questioningly. "Were you helping slaves to escape?" "Of course I was. I fed them, hid them during the day, and when night came, I pointed them toward a free black family who'd feed and hide them the next day." I smiled and said nothing. He sounded angry, almost defensive about what he had done. "I guess I'm not used to saying things like that to people who understand them," he said. "I know. It's enough that you did what you did." He rubbed his head again. 5 years is longer than it sounds. So much longer." We went on to his office. Both our offices were ex-bedrooms in the solidly built old frame house we had bought. They were big, comfortable rooms that reminded me a little of the rooms in the Wayland house. "No." I shook my head, denying the impression. "This house was nothing like the Wayland house." I watched Kevin look around his office. He circled the room, stopping at his desk, at the file cabinets, at the bookcases.
He stood for a moment, looking at the shelf filled with copies of The Water of Meribah, his most successful novel, the novel that had bought us this house. He touched a copy as though to take it down, then left it and drifted back to his typewriter. He fumbled with that for a moment, remembered how to turn it on, then looked at the stack of blank paper beside it and turned it off again. Abruptly, he brought his fist down hard on it. I jumped at the sudden sound. "You'll break it, Kevin. What difference would that make?" I winced, remembered my own attempts to write when I'd been home last. I had tried and tried and only managed to fill the wastebasket. "What am I going to do?" said Kevin, turning his back on the typewriter. "Christ, if I can't feel anything even in here."
"You will. Give yourself time."
He picked up his electric pencil sharpener, examined it as though he did not know what it was, then seemed to remember. He put it down, took a pencil from a china cup on the desk, and put it in the sharpener. The little machine obligingly ground the pencil to a fine point. Kevin stared at the point for a moment, then at the sharpener. "A toy," he said.
"Nothing but a damn toy."
"That's what I said when you bought it," I told him. I tried to smile and make a joke, but there was something in his voice that scared me. With a sudden slash of his hand, he knocked both the sharpener and the cup of pencils from his desk. The pencil scattered and the cup broke. The sharpener bounced hard on the bare floor, just missing the rug. I unplugged it quickly.
"Kevin."
He stalked out of the room before I could finish. I ran after him, caught his arm. "Kevin!" He stopped, glared at me as though I was some stranger who had dared to lay hands on him.
"Kevin, you can't come back all at once any more than you can leave all at once. It takes time. After a while, though, things will fall into place."
His expression did not change. I took his face between my hands and looked into his eyes, now truly cold. "I don't know what it was like for you," I said, "being gone so long, having so little control over whether you'd ever get back. I can't really know, I guess. But I do know that I almost didn't want to be alive when I thought I'd left you behind for good. But now that you're back..." He pulled away from me and walked out of the room. The expression on his face was like something I'd seen, something I was used to seeing on Tom Whalen, something closed and ugly. I didn't go after him when I left his office. I didn't know what to do to help him, and I didn't want to look at him and see things that reminded me of Whalen. But because I went to the bedroom, I found him. He was standing beside the dresser looking at a picture of himself as he had been. He had always hated having his picture taken, but I had talked him into this one. A close-up of the young face under a cap of thick gray hair, dark brows, pale eyes. I was afraid he would throw the picture down, smash it as he had tried to smash the pencil sharpener. I took it from his hand. He let it go easily and turned to look at himself in the dresser mirror. He ran a hand through his hair, still thick and gray. He would probably never be bald. But he looked old now. The young face had changed more than could be accounted for by the new lines in his face or the beard.
"Kevin?"
He closed his eyes.
"Leave me alone for a while, Dana," he said softly. "I just need to be by myself and get used to things again."
There was suddenly a loud, house-shaking sonic boom, and Kevin jumped back against the dresser, looking around wildly.
"Just a jet passing overhead," I told him.
He gave me what almost seemed to be a look of hatred, then brushed past me, went into his office, and shut the door. I left him alone. I didn't know what else to do, or even whether there was anything I could do. Maybe this was something he had to work out for himself. Maybe it was something that only time could help. Maybe anything. But I felt so damned helpless as I looked down the hall at his closed door. Finally, I went to bathe.
and that hurt enough to hold my attention for a while. Then I checked my denim bag, put in a bottle of antiseptic, Kevin's large bottle of Excedrin, and an old pocket knife to replace the switchblade. The knife was large and easily as deadly as the switchblade I had lost, but I wouldn't be able to use it as quickly, and I would have a harder time surprising an opponent with it. I considered taking a kitchen knife of some kind instead, but I thought one big enough to be effective would be too hard to hide. Not that any kind of knife had been very effective for me so far. Having one just made me feel safer. I dropped the knife into the bag and replaced soap, toothpaste, some clothing, a few other things. My thoughts went back to Kevin. Did he blame me for the 5 years he had lost, I wondered? Or if he didn't now, would he when he tried to write again? He would try. Writing was his profession. I wondered whether he had been able to write during the 5 years, or rather, whether he had been able to publish. I was sure he had been writing. I couldn't imagine either of us going for 5 years without writing. Maybe he'd kept a journal or something. He had changed. In 5 years, he couldn't help changing. But the markets he wrote for hadn't changed. He might have a frustrating time for a while, and he might blame me. It had been so good seeing him again, loving him, knowing his exile was ended. I had thought everything would be all right. Now I wondered if anything would be all right. I put on a loose dress and went to the kitchen to see what we could make a meal of, if I could get Kevin to eat. The chops I had put out to defrost over 2 months ago were still icy. How long had we been away then? What day was it? Somehow neither of us had bothered to find out. I turned on the radio and found a news station, tuned it right into the middle of a story about the war in Lebanon. The war there was worse. The president was ordering an evacuation of non-official Americans. That sounded like what he had been ordering on the day Rufus called me. A moment later, the announcer mentioned the day, confirming what I had thought. I had been away for only a few hours. Kevin had been away for 8 days. 1976 had not gone on without us. The news switched to a story about South Africa, blacks rioting there and dying wholesale in battles with police over the policies of the white supremacist government. I turned off the radio and tried to cook the meal in peace. South African whites had always struck me as people who would have been happier living in the 19th century or the 18th. In fact, they were living in the past as far as their race relations went. They lived in ease and comfort, supported by huge numbers of blacks whom they kept in poverty and held in contempt. Tom Whalen would have felt right at home. After a while, the smell of food brought Kevin out of his office, but he ate in silence. "Can't I help?" I asked finally. "Help with what?" There was an edge to his voice that made me wary. I didn't answer. "I'm all right," he said grudgingly. "No, you're not." He put his fork down. "How long were you away this time?" "A few hours. Or just over 2 months. Take your pick." "There was a newspaper in my office. I was reading it. I don't know how old it is, but..." "It's today's paper. It came the morning Rufus called me last. That's this morning, if you want to believe the calendar. June 18th. "It doesn't matter. I've wasted my time reading that paper. I didn't know what the hell it was talking about most of the time." "It's like I said, the confusion doesn't go away all at once. It doesn't for me either. It was so good coming home at first." "It was good. It still is." "I don't know. I don't know anything." "You're in too much of a hurry. You..." I stopped, realized I was swaying a little on my chair. "Oh, God, no," I whispered. "I suppose I am," said Kevin. "I wonder how people just out of prison manage to readjust." "Kevin, go get my bag. I left it in the bedroom." "What? Why? Go, Kevin!" He went, understanding finally. I sat still, praying that he would come back in time. I could feel tears streaming down my face. So soon. So soon. Why couldn't I have just had a few days with him, a few days of peace at home? I felt something pressed into my hands, and I grasped it. My bag. I opened my eyes to the dark blur of it, and the larger blur of Kevin standing near me. I was suddenly afraid of what he might do. "Get away, Kevin!" He said something, but suddenly there was too much noise for me to hear him, even if he had still been there. 2. There was water, rain pouring down on me. I was sitting in mud, clutching my bag. I got up, sheltering my bag as much as I could, so that eventually I'd have something dry to change into. I looked around grimly for Rufus. I couldn't find him. I peered through the dim, gray light, looked around until I realized where I was. I could see the familiar boxy Whalen house in the distance. Yellow light at one window. At least there would be no long walk for me this time. In this storm, that was something to be grateful for. But where was Rufus? If he was in trouble inside the house, why had I arrived outside? I shrugged and started toward the house. If he was there, it would be stupid for me to waste time out here. Not that I could get any wetter. I tripped over him. He was lying face down in a puddle so deep the water almost covered his head. Face down. I grabbed him and pulled him out of the water and over to a tree that would shelter us a little from the rain. A moment later, there was thunder and a flash of lightning, and I dragged him away from the tree again. With his ability to draw bad luck, I didn't want to take chances. He was alive. As I moved him, he threw up on himself and partly on me. I almost joined him. He began to cough and mutter, and I realized that he was either drunk or sick. More probably drunk. He was also heavy. He didn't look any bigger than he had when I saw him last, but he was soaking wet now, and he was beginning to struggle feebly. I had been dragging him toward the house while he was still. Now I dropped him in disgust and went to the house alone. Some stronger, more tolerant person could drag or carry him the rest of the way. Nigel answered the door, stood peering down at me.
"Who the devil?"
"It's Dana, Nigel."
"Dana?"
He was suddenly alert.
"What happened? Where's Moss Roof?"
"Out there. He was too heavy for me."
"Where?"
I looked back the way I had come and could not see Rufus. If he had flipped himself over again. "Damn," I muttered. "Come on." I led him back to the gray lump, still face up. That was Rufus. "Watch it," I said. He threw up on me. Nigel picked Rufus up like a sack of grain, threw him over his shoulder, and strode back to the house in such quick, long strides that I had to run to keep up. Rufus threw up again down Nigel's back, but Nigel paid no attention. The rain washed them both fairly clean before we reached the house. Inside, we met Whalen, who was coming down the stairs. He stopped short as he saw us.
"You,"
he said, staring at me. "Hello, Mr. Whalen," I said wearily. He looked bent and old, thinner than ever. He walked with a cane.
"Is Rufus all right? Is he..."
"He's alive," I said. "I found him unconscious, face down in a ditch. A little more and he would have drowned."
"If you're here, I suppose he would have."
The old man looked at Nigel.
"Take him up to his room and put him to bed. Dana, you..."
He stopped, looked at my dripping, clinging, to him, immodestly short dress. It was the kind of loose smock-like garment that little children of both sexes wore before they were old enough to work. It clearly offended Whalen more than my pants ever had.
"Haven't you got something decent to put on?"
he asked. I looked at my wet bag. Decent, maybe, but probably not dry.
"Go put on what you got, then come back down to the library."
He wanted to talk to me, I thought. Just what I needed at the end of a long, jumbled day. Whalen didn't talk to me normally except to give orders. When he did, It was always harrowing. There was so much I couldn't say. He took offense so easily. I followed Nigel up the stairs, then went on to the narrow, ladder-like attic stairs. My old corner was empty, so I went there to put my bag down and search through it. I found a nearly dry shirt and a pair of Levi's that were wet only at the ankles. I dried myself, changed, combed my hair, and spread out some of my wettest clothing to dry. Then I went down to Waylon. I had learned not to worry about leaving my things in the attic. Other house servants examined them. I knew because I had caught them at it now and then, but nothing was ever missing. Apprehensively, I went through the library door.
"You look as young as you ever did," Waylon complained sourly when he saw me.
"Yes, sir." I'd agreed with anything he said if it would get me away from him sooner.
"What happened to you there? Your face?"
I touched the scab. "That's where you kicked me, Mr. Waylon." He had been sitting in a worn old armchair, but now he surged out of it like a young man, his cane a blunt wooden sword before him.
"What are you talking about? It's been 6 years since I seen you."
"Yes, sir."
"Well?"
"For me, it's only been a few hours." I thought Rufus and Kevin had probably told him enough to enable him to understand whether he believed it or not. And perhaps he did understand. He seemed to get angrier.
"Who in the hell ever said you were an educated nigger? You can't even tell a decent lie. 6 years for me is 6 years for you."
"Yes, sir." Why did he bother to ask me questions? Why did I bother to answer them? He sat down again and leaned forward, one hand resting on his cane. His voice was softer, though, when he spoke.
"At Franklin. Get back home all right?"
"Yes, sir." What would happen if I asked him where he thought that home was? But no, he had done at least one decent thing for Kevin and me, no matter what he was. I met his eyes for a moment. "Thank you."
"I didn't do it for you."
My temper flared suddenly.
"I don't give a damn why you did it. I'm just telling you, one human being from another, that I'm grateful. Why can't you leave it at that?"
The old man's face went pale.
"You want a good whipping," he said. "You must not have had one for a while."
I said nothing. I realized then, though, that if he ever hit me again, I would break his scrawny neck. I would not endure it again. Waylon leaned back in his chair.
"Rufus always said you didn't know your place any better than a wild animal," he muttered. "I always said you were just another crazy nigger."
I stood watching him.
"Why'd you help my son again?" he asked.
I settled down a little, shrugged. Nobody ought to die the way he would have, lying in a ditch, drowning in mud and whiskey and his own vomit.
"Stop it," Waylon shouted. "I'll take the cowhide to you myself. I'll..."
He fell silent, gasped for breath. His face was still dead white. He'd make himself really sick if he didn't regain some of his old control. I dropped back into indifference. "Yes, sir." After a moment, he had control of himself. In fact, he sounded perfectly calm again.
"You and Rufus had some trouble when you saw him last."
"Yes, sir." Having Rufus try to shoot me had been troublesome.
"I hoped you would go on helping him. You know there's always a home for you here if you do."
I smiled a little in spite of myself. "Bad nigger that I am, eh?
Is that the way you think of yourself?"
I laughed bitterly. "No, I don't kid myself much. Your son is still alive, isn't he?"
"You're bad enough. I don't know any other white man who would put up with you."
"If you can manage to put up with me a little more humanely, I'll go on doing what I can do for Mr. Rufus." He frowned.
"Now what are you talking about?"
"I'm saying the day I'm beaten just once more, your son is on his own." His eyes widened, perhaps in surprise. Then he began to tremble. I had never before seen a man literally trembling with anger.
You're threatening him, he stammered. By God, you're crazy!
Crazy or sane, I mean what I say. My back and side ached as though to warn me, but for the moment I wasn't afraid. He loved his son no matter how he behaved toward him, and he knew I could do as I threatened. At the rate Mr. Rufus has accidents, I said, he might live another 6 or 7 years without me. I wouldn't count on more than that.
You damn black bitch!
He shook his cane at me like an extended forefinger.
If you think you can get away with making threats, giving orders...
He ran out of breath and began gasping again. I watched without sympathy, wondering whether he was already sick.
Get out, he gasped. Go to Rufus. Take care of him. If anything happens to him, I'll flay you alive.
My aunt used to say things like that to me when I was little and did something to annoy her. Girl, I'm gonna skin you alive. And she'd get my uncle's belt and use it on me. But it had never occurred to me that anyone could make such a threat and mean it literally as Waylon meant it now. I turned and left him before he could see that my courage had vanished. He could get help from his neighbors, from the patrollers, probably even from whatever police officials the area had. He could do anything he wanted to me, and I had no enforceable rights. None at all. 3. Rufus was sick again. When I reached his room, I found him lying in bed, shaking violently, while Nigel tried to keep him wrapped in blankets. What's wrong with him? I asked.
Nothing, said Nigel. Got the ague again, I guess.
Ague?
Yeah, he's had it before. He'll be all right.
He didn't look all right to me. Has anyone gone for the doctor?
Mars Tom don't hardly get Doc West for ague. He says all the doc knows is bleeding and blistering and purging and puking and making folks sicker than they was to start.
I swallowed, remembered the pompous little man I had disliked so. Is the doctor really that bad, Nigel?
He gave me some stuff once, nearly killed me. From then on, I just let Sarah doctor me when I'm sick. Least she don't dose niggas like they horses or mules.
I shook my head and went close to Rufus's bed. He looked miserable, seemed to be in pain. I tried to think what the ague might be. The word was familiar, but I couldn't remember what I'd heard or read about it. Rufus looked up at me, red-eyed, and tried to smile, though the grimace he managed was far from pleasant. To my surprise, his attempt touched me. I hadn't expected to still care about him except for my own and my family's sake. I didn't want to care. Idiot, I muttered down at him. He managed to look hurt. I looked at Nigel, wondered whether the disease could be as unimportant as he thought. Would he think it was important if he had been the one on his back shaking? Nigel was busy plucking his wet shirt away from his skin. No one had given him a chance to change his clothes, I realized. Nigel, I'll stay here if you want to go dry off, I said. He looked up, smiled at me.
You go away for 6 years, he said, then come back and fit right in. It's like you never left.
Every time I go, I keep hoping I'll never come back. He nodded.
But at least you get some time of freedom.
I looked away, feeling strangely guilty that, yes, I did get some time of freedom. Not enough, but probably more than Nigel would ever know. I didn't like feeling guilty about it. Then something bit me on my ear, and I forgot my guilt. As I slapped at my ear, I remembered finally what the ague was. Malaria. I wondered dully whether the mosquito that had just bitten me was carrying the disease. In my reading, I'd come across a lot of information on malaria, and none of it led me to believe the disease was as harmless as Nigel seemed to think. It might not kill, but it weakened and it recurred, and it could lower one's resistance to other diseases. Also, with Rufus lying exposed as he was to new mosquito attacks, The disease could be spread over the plantation and beyond. Nigel, is there anything we could hang up here to keep the mosquitoes off him?
Mosquitoes? He wouldn't feel it if 20 mosquitoes bit him now.
No, but the rest of us would be feeling it eventually.
What do you mean?
Does anyone else have it now?
Don't think so. Some of the children are sick, but I think they have something wrong with their faces. One side all swollen up.
Mumps? Never mind. Well, let's see if we can keep this from spreading. Is there any kind of mosquito netting or whatever people use here?
Sure, for white folks. But
would you get some? With the help of the canopy, we should be able to enclose him completely.
Dana, listen.
I looked at him.
What do mosquitoes have to do with the ague?
I blinked, stared at him in surprise. He didn't know. Of course he didn't. Doctors of the day didn't know, which probably meant that Nigel wouldn't believe me when I told him. After all, how could a thing as tiny as a mosquito make anybody sick? Nigel, you know where I'm from, don't you? He gave me something that wasn't quite a smile.
Not New York.
No.
I know where Mars Roof said you was from.
It shouldn't be that hard for you to believe him. You've seen me go home at least once.
Twice.
Well? He shrugged.
I can't say. If I hadn't seen the way you go home, I'd just figure you were one crazy nigger. But I haven't ever seen anybody do what you did. I don't want to believe you, but I guess I do.
Good. I took a deep breath. Where I'm from, people have learned that mosquitoes carry ague. They bite someone who's sick with it, and then later they bite healthy people and give them the disease.
How?
They suck blood from the sick and pass on some of that blood when they bite a healthy person. Like a mad dog that bites a man and drives the man mad. No talk about microorganisms. Nigel not only wouldn't believe me, he might decide I really was crazy.
Doc says it's something in the air that spreads ague. Something off bad water and garbage. A miasma, he called it.
He's wrong. He's wrong about the bleeding and purging and the rest. He was wrong when he dosed you, and he's wrong now. It's a wonder any of his patients survive.
I heard he was good and quick when it comes to cutting off legs or arms.
I had to look at Nigel to see whether he was making a grisly joke.
He wasn't.
Get the mosquito net, I said wearily. Let's do what we can to keep that butcher away from here. He nodded and went away. I wondered whether or not he believed me, but it really didn't matter. It wouldn't cost anyone anything to take this small precaution. I looked down at Rufus to see that he had stopped trembling and closed his eyes. His breathing was regular, and I thought he was asleep. Why do you keep trying to kill yourself? I said softly. I hadn't expected an answer, so I was surprised when he spoke quietly.
Most of the time, living just isn't worth the trouble.
I sat down next to his bed. It never occurred to me that you might really want to die.
I don't.
He opened his eyes, looked at me, then shut them again and covered them with his hands.
But if your eyes and your head and your leg hurt the way mine do, dying might start to look good.
Your eyes hurt?
When I look around.
Did they hurt before when you had ague?
No, this isn't ague. Ague is bad enough. My leg feels like it's coming off, and my head.
He scared me. His pain seemed to increase, and he twisted his body as though to move away from it, then untwisted quickly and lay panting. Roof, I'm going to get your father. If he sees how sick you are, he'll send for the doctor. He seemed to be too involved with his own pain to answer. I didn't want to leave him until Nigel came back, though I had no idea what I could do for him. My problem was solved when Waylon came in with Nigel.
What is all this about mosquitoes giving people ague?
He demanded.
We may be able to forget about that, I said. This doesn't look like malaria. Ague. He's in a lot of pain. I think someone should go for the doctor.
You're doctor enough for him.
But I stopped, took a deep breath, made myself calm down. Rufus was groaning behind me. Mr. Whalen, I'm no doctor. I don't have any idea what's wrong with him. Whatever professional help is available, you should get it for him.
Should I now?
His life may be at stake. Whalen's mouth was set in a straight, hard line.
If he dies, you die, and you won't die easy.
You already said that. But no matter what you do to me, your son will still be dead. Is that what you want?
You do your job, he said stubbornly, and he'll live. You're something different. I don't know what, witch, devil, I don't care. Whatever you are, you just about brought a girl back to life when you come here last, and she wasn't even the one you came to help. You come out of nowhere and go back into nowhere. Years ago, I would have sworn there couldn't even be anybody like you. You're not natural, but you can feel pain, and you can die. Remember that and do your job. Take care of your master.
But I tell you, he walked out of the room and shut the door behind him. 4. We got the mosquito netting and used it, just in case. Nigel said Whalen didn't really mind letting us have it. He just didn't want to hear any more damned nonsense about mosquitoes. He didn't like to be taken for a fool. He's as close to being scared of you as he's ever been of anything, said Nigel. I think he'd rather try to kill you than admit it, though. I don't see any sign of fear in him.
You don't know him the way I do, Nigel paused. Could he kill you, Dana?
I don't know. It's possible.
We better get Ma's roof well, then. Sarah has this kind of tea she makes that kind of helps the ague. Maybe it'll help whatever Ma's roof has now.
Would you ask her to brew up a pot? He nodded and went out. Sarah came upstairs with Nigel to bring Rufus the tea and to see me. She looked old now. Her hair was streaked with gray and her face lined. She walked with a limp.
Dropped a kettle on my foot, she said. Couldn't walk at all for